I see kitchen staff leaving the kitchen and going to the front of the hotel. That was a warning sign. If hotel staff is bolting out of the kitchen, I'd better get up back to my 14th floor room. That is the first time that I said, okay, the danger is getting close to home. And from the 14th floor, I see a group congregating outside the hotel gates, and a building across the street was set on fire. So now the danger is really getting close to home. That's when I started to shift my mindset of remain calm, but be prepared to evacuate.
Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we welcome Michael Rubiano, a member of what I consider the old guard, from Freddy's to Megadoo's to so many other frequent flyer aspects. Michael, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Trevor. Thank you, Thomas.
I realize I've given you just a very short introduction, and for some of our listeners, they probably don't fully understand. I know that we've talked about the Freddie Awards in the past, so I'm going to assume that many of our listeners are familiar with that. But I don't know that we've talked about Megadoo's, and I feel like that's one of those areas that we built our friendship sort of on, you know, the Freddie's, the Megadoo's, and just generally running into each other. Could you tell us a little bit about the Megadoo sort of events, just so our listeners know, kind of, you know, one of those things? I almost think at this point it's almost in memoriam because we haven't seen one recently.
So again, thank you for having me on. And yes, the Megadoo's, what that stands for in plain English, it's mega, big, do, to do, Megadoo. And what it is an in-person gathering of a large bunch of travel geeks, mostly folks who met online at places like Flyer Talk, Milepoint during its brief incarnation, but a lot of us met on Flyer Talk in various forums and decided that it would be really great that have do's, which in Flyer Talk language meant small gatherings of frequent flyer folks just to talk miles and points. Mega do, meaning a whole bunch more people. And about 13, 14 years ago now, somebody had the crazy idea of saying, what if we charter a jet? And what if we travel to different places like Toulouse to see the Airbus factory? Or what if we go to see the Lufthansa Technik headquarters? So you get enough people who drink enough beer and like enough alcohol and love miles and points, and they said, sure, sounds like a great idea. And so they had a bunch, you know, figured out how to charter an aircraft. I mean, we're talking like, you know, charter an aircraft to go from city to city, hopping around. Star Megadoo 2 was my first one, where we hopped to Europe, and then we did a domestic leg that went from, I can't even remember the details now. I do remember Star Megadoo 3, where we chartered the 787 Dreamliner with United Airlines just before it went into full service. And we flew that from San Francisco to Houston to Chicago and met with then CEO Jeff Smizek. But in any case, that's what a Megadoo is. It's a gathering of frequent flyer aficionados talking about miles, points, and going behind the scenes in places that you don't normally get to see in an airplane, in an airport, in a hotel.
Really nerding out for us aviation geeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, it sounds like Megadoo is, we haven't had any recent ones or there haven't been any around, but, you know, Flyer Talk still does exist and it's still a pretty good resource. And for those of our listeners who are not familiar, it is a pretty good forum site that just has a lot of longtime experts on various programs. And there's a really good thread there for things like mileage running and things that I still look at even now, even though it's probably a little bit less relevant than it was back in the past.
Hey, I go into that Premium Fare Deals, I guess it's a channel, or I can't even remember what we call them now, but I look into those Premium Fare Deals probably at least once, twice a week. So, I mean, I think there's still a lot of stuff that's relevant. You see the content is updated. So Flyer Talk again, is I think still relevant. It's just perhaps there's just so many other things. There's, you know, how many things can you keep track of? You know, you've got Discord, you've got Telegram, you've got Slack, you've got Facebook. There's so many different areas and avenues now. Whereas when I started, and Michael, probably when you started, I mean, effectively, Flyer Talk was the 1,000-pound gorilla.
Yep. It's like the gold standard.
Indeed. And just to tie a little bit of history, because you've said you've talked about the Freddies on the podcast, Flyer Talk was founded by the person whom I consider to be the godfather of miles and points, Randy Peterson. So he started Flyer Talk because his desire, if you don't know Randy personally, he is just a very warm, generous human being. He loves helping other people, and specifically, he helps love people using their miles and points in a smarter way. And he was getting a lot of questions about how do you leverage this? What should I do here? And he thought, well, I can't really serve as many people as I want on a many-to-one basis. So he created a platform, you know, a bulletin board service, for those who remember what that is, a BBS, called Flyer Talk. And it enabled, the idea behind it was that people would help one another, that fellow frequent flyers and miles and points geeks would help each other out, and it was a way to share information. Flyer Talk really begat the blogosphere that exists today. You know, before you had people like Gary Leffett, View from the Wing, before you had One Mile at a Time, before you had Frequent Miler, before you had Mommy Points, and before you had The Points Guy, they all found a home through Flyer Talk. And I think now blogs have sort of replaced, for the masses, the insider information that used to only be exchanged in private forums. And so I think blogs are an easier, and podcasts are an easier and more natural outlet for people who are still new-ish to the game. And I say new-ish as a relative term. I mean, I've been doing this for the better part of 30 years of miles and points. I started out doing this in college, you know, figuring out, oh, if I get these certificates to, you know, fly cheaply, if I pick up an American Express card, I still earn full miles and points on this. This is incredible. And I would rack up elite status on a bunch of cheap flights in the days when miles counted, not dollars spent. In any case, all of that information was shared freely more on Flyer Talk, but now is more on a blog and podcast outlet.
Yeah, and the blogs and the podcasts, I think, really distill the wheat from the chaff. I think Flyer Talk, there was a lot of gold there, but it took a lot more work in some cases. Mm-hmm. And I think the blogs and podcasts have made it much more accessible. But let's double click into that status piece, because I think, if I recall, that sort of helped drive you for the main topic of our show today, which is, and we're calling this episode, Off the Rails in Nepal. So I think your status had sort of driven you in a particular path that ultimately got you to Nepal. Can you give us a little bit of that backstory and set the stage, if you will?
So first of all, I am a lifetime Premier 1K, and how I got there was not by flying 3 million butt-in seat miles on United, but rather flying 5 years in a row of top-tier status back when United was Continental Airlines. And they had a promotion because they were in the throes of Chapter 11, I think, a couple of times, at least two bankruptcies. And they weren't a very big carrier, and they had lots of promotions. They had a great loyalty program, OnePass. And essentially, they said at the time, Gordon Bethune was the CEO, he said, okay, listen, if you guys can fly 5 years of top-tier status, which at the time had started out at 50,000 miles and then at one point went up to 75,000 miles. And you think about those numbers. Back then, when I was in college, that sounded like a lot. These days, I can fly, you know, that's like the first quarter of the year.
Pedestrian numbers.
Yeah, pedestrian, very pedestrian levels. But anyway, so that's how I achieved my lifetime status with Continental. And then when the Continental management team basically took over United, and kept the United name, they said those of us that were lifetime elites with Continental Airlines would have lifetime Premier 1K status. And so I am a top tier, well, not global services, but I am a Premier 1K for life with United. But frankly, United miles have become less valuable the last 5 to 7 years. And I live out on the West Coast. I'm originally from New York City, but I live out on the West Coast now. And it was actually during, we talked about Megadoo to start. It was the One World Megadoo. So the Megadoos star 1, 2, and 3 had been all about Star Alliance. Megadoo 4 was the One World Megadoo with American Airlines. And that was my first experience with what executive platinum status meant and what One World Emerald status meant. Once I got a taste of that, I was hooked, right? And because, you know, again, this is before Americans started devaluing, before the US Airways management took over, there was a lot of value I felt to be extracted out of the American Advantage program.
The good old days.
Yeah, good old days. I'm less sanguine about it now, but I am very, very high on Alaska, formerly known as Mileage Plan, but now as Atmos Rewards. I think Alaska is the best domestic frequent flyer program in the United States, both in terms of the earning potential, the value potential, and even with the merge to Atmos Rewards from their previous Mileage Plan moniker, I think they have moved in ways that are still very consumer friendly while still recognizing that it's a revenue generation tool to drive more money to the bottom line.
I think I would agree with that. I think a strong argument can be made with, you know, Atmos being argued as the most valuable loyalty program for customers. You know, I definitely think they left enough in the program, you know, and again, one of the last programs where you have the option to qualify the old fashioned way, right? You know, using miles instead of revenue.
And it is a mile flown, a mile earned still, if I recall, right?
Yes. And in 2026, they are going to give you three options. You can choose your own adventure. One is segment based, one is revenue based, and one is traditional mileage based. But once you pick your option, that's the option that you have to live with for the rest of the year. I certainly know which one I'm going to use. And I suspect that a lot of folks in the frequent flyer community are likely, if they are Alaska loyalty members, status members, are probably going to go with the standard mileage distance as their option, unless they are flying a lot for business. But I think that's where there's a difference between practicality and loyalty practicality. Alaska doesn't necessarily have as great a domestic network and a footprint, so to speak, of the places that they go. It works well if you live on the West Coast. It works well if you're traveling to Boston or New York or DC, let's say. They'll have enough frequency and lift. But I don't think they have enough coverage in the interior. So I think it's going to be a hard sell for those who choose the money option. But certainly there are those folks for whom that will work. But I think for the miles and points geeks, they'll do the mileage.
Great for you on the West Coast, right? I mean, I think Alaska, I think West Coast customers of Alaska, you know, they're pretty well taken care of. And the network out there is pretty good. But you're right, for those of us here, DC area, we have enough flights, actually. I mean, we have flights out to like Portland and Seattle and San Francisco and a couple other places, but it's pretty limited just to the transcon. You know, we don't have a lot of options to actually fly Alaska or Hawaiian from the DC area.
So I'm really curious about this because I would have thought as a partial West Coaster that segment status might have actually been attractive to you, given how exhaustive that network is.
Well, if you want to get a little geeky about this on a cents per mile flown, you know, if you want to do the analysis, I mean, flying down to Los Angeles is a really easy, not that I fly to Los Angeles frequently, but the cost per mile flown to Los Angeles from a status earner is way disproportionate to and less value than me flying out to the East Coast, right? I still get a lot more value and a lot less actual out-of-pocket cost flying to the East Coast on Alaska than I would just flying down to Los Angeles. So segments will not work for this particular flyer. It could work for some.
Nope, that makes a lot of sense. And I think if your metric is the cost per mile, then yeah, I think it almost changes. And I haven't done the math on the number of segments that you've got to do to be able to get the top tier status with Atmos. But I mean, I know that some folks, you know, almost use a different metric based on whether they're going for the segments or the miles. But I mean, I think miles is the traditional metric.
I mean, I'm just going to give a plug out real quickly to The Flight Deal, one of my favorite sites that, you know, always identifies their reason for existence was for the mileage runners, figuring out, you know, what are the deals that cost less than 6 cents per mile, I think is what their original metric was. And I use them for a lot of my mileage running when I was still going for American Executive Platinum status. So again, I've been doing this for a while. It's going to be hard for me to change my ways at this point, but I am very much the value seeker in all of this.
Oh yeah, a leopard has a hard time changing their spots. Yeah,
that's right.
So let's dive into this trip. So obviously your status sort of drove a little bit of your thinking.
It drove almost all of my thinking. who are we kidding?
Yeah. And a quirk of the, just before we get off the Atmos piece, there's a quirk of that program, right? Like that's the only program also that is giving you credit for some of your award travel, right? So did that played into this trip as well, did it not?
I couldn't have set it up any better. I mean, let me just add one more piece. So
sure.
I'm also a Hyatt Globalist, formerly Diamond back in the day. How I got introduced to that status was also on a Megadoo. Jeff Seidel, who was the head of the then Gold Passport program, had an offer for those of us on Star Megadoo 3. You know, you go on Star Megadoo 3, you complete, at that time, it was stay-based, not night-based to get top-tier status. You know, we had to do some ridiculously low number of stays to get top-tier status. And once we tasted what Hyatt top tier status meant, we realized, you know, because at the time it was SPG that was Starwood Preferred Guest. That was the loyalty program when it came to hotels. And they had a wider footprint and they had a more well-known program. They had a better credit card program. Hyatt didn't even have a credit card at the time. So it was the introduction of that Diamond status that got a lot of us in the miles and points game hooked on the Hyatt status wheel. And so this trip, going now to the Nepal piece, was very much driven by the fact that I'm a deal stacker, okay? What I do when I look for trips are, can I do it with family, friends, and loved ones? And if I can't, that's okay too. I'm happy doing solo travel, but love to do it with friends and family and loved ones. Number two, is it a place that I've not been yet? I mean, in my lifetime, I've flown on my, according to my flight diary, something like 2.1 million button seat miles. You know, I've been lots of places, not everywhere, but lots of places. And I'm always seeking the new and the novel. So that's criteria number two. Criteria number three, does it help me achieve or re-achieve air and or hotel status? Four, is my overall cost reasonable enough to me? That's the decision matrix in choosing a destination. And so if I can get there on a oneworld airline, if I can stay at a Hyatt, if I can limit my costs, and if I can do it with a loved one or have a portion of the travel with a loved one at least, I'm all in.
I love how you just really summarized your four sort of tenets for as you book travel. I mean, I think a lot of us have those sort of concepts in our minds, but I don't know that I've ever conveyed them nearly as succinctly and clearly as you just did here. And so I think that's awesome. That's a great thing for our listeners to hear.
I think there's a lot of head nodding because, you know, all three of us, I feel like we're all part of the old guard, and all the things you just mentioned are pretty much the same kind of thoughts and kind of philosophy, I'm sure, that all of us follow during most of these travel stories that you're hearing about on this podcast. So I'm glad to hear you talking about them. A lot of them are resonating and making a lot of sense, at least to me.
Well, thank you.
Oh, absolutely.
And Thomas, to your point about, so a unique aspect of the at least for domestic U.S. programs. There are some international programs that do what Alaska does, but at least domestically U.S., what is unique about Alaska is that for Alaska Airlines booked awards through them, whether it's a oneworld carrier or not, they will issue status, elite status miles. You're not going to earn RDMs, redeemable miles, but you will earn, I still call them EQMs, even though that term is kind of old school. So.
And that's brand new for 2025, right? That started this year. That was not the case prior to this year. So that is a new thing.
Absolutely. And so I laugh now because I sometimes am kicking myself. I'm too clever by half sometimes. So my girlfriend and her son were going to do a liveaboard dive trip in Palau, another place I'd love to go. Now, I like diving, but I don't love diving the way they do. I mean, that's talking about four dives a day, 5 or 6 days in a row, living on a boat. And again, I've been to Antarctica. I've been to the Arctic on a ship, my only two times on cruise ships. But I wouldn't really say I'm a boat guy. Plus, no Hyatts there, right? I could get there on the oneworld carriers, but I couldn't stay at a Hyatt. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to dish out how many thousands of dollars to live on a boat and do something? I was like, okay. But
they have one in Guam.
This is the kicker. They said they were going to fly Cathay Pacific through Hong Kong to get to Palau. Lights go off. Cathay Pacific, ding, ding, one ding, world ding. Carrier, ding, 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 ding. One world miles that I have Alaska miles that I'm going to be able to use to get to Hong Kong. And I said, you know, she's not one of us. She's not a miles. I don't even think she collected miles and points until she met me. I was like, horror. So she's certainly never been to the pier, the first class lounge for Cathay Pacific in Hong Kong, one of the favorites, you know, throughout the One World Network. And I think even one of my favorite lounges of any airline.
Agreed.
I can name a few that are certainly better, but
one of the best in the world. One of the best in the world. Yeah.
I haven't been to Hong Kong or the pier since before the pandemic. So I said, okay, I'll fly with you to Hong Kong. I'll get you into the lounge. I can guess one person in. And it used to be that I could guess one person into one cafe lounge and another person into another cafe lounge. They now scan the boarding passes so they know who you guessed it in. But, you know, we have how many premium credit cards do we have and priority pass? I got her son into a different lounge and my girlfriend and I are chilling in the pier. Anyway, so we can get to Hong Kong together and we can rendezvous back in Hong Kong. The question is, what do I do for a week while they're in Palau on a dive boat? So again, I'm just trying to figure out what is the furthest distance I can go for the fewest amount of award miles in the shortest amount of time to be able to actually see things at the destination in a new place where there are Hyatts, right?
Maximize
the deal. So I'm looking at the map. Where does Cathay fly to Hong Kong that I can go that is available on the Alaska Award, on the same award coming out of San Francisco, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, ended up with Nepal. Lo and behold, Nepal has two Hyatts and it's dirt cheap. And Mount Everest. My girlfriend, in addition to diving, she's a mountain climber. She's been to Nepal, not to climb Everest, but she has climbed mountains. No way am I going to put on crampons on my feet, you know, put on layers and ice picks and ropes and climb any mountains in Nepal. So I figured this is the only way ever I am going to get a chance to see Everest. I'm in a new country, low cost, two Hyatts, and I'm extending the amount of miles that I've flown on this One World Award issued by Alaska on Cathay Pacific. Boom, 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 boom.
Checking boxes on the list, huh? It met all the requirements.
That's exactly right. I was like, hey, I could do 3-4 days in Nepal easy, take a break, meet back in Hong Kong, stop in Macau for a day, meet them back on the flight, and then go on.
So to this point, the stars have aligned.
Totally.
Things are going well.
Everything is going well. And I love going to places where I'm a little uncomfortable. And I say that with a touch of irony now, because I got a lot uncomfortable. But
be careful, you know, what you wish for.
Exactly. And I just, some people, and I'm not denigrating anybody's travel style, people need to be comfortable with themselves and where they go. I am very much what we call in the travel advisor industry. I am, by the way, a luxury travel advisor. I can talk a little bit about that later, but we call it FIT, you know, free independent travelers. I travel on my own. I don't ever do group tours. I loathe them. I cannot stand the idea of following somebody with a flag. You drop me in the middle of somewhere and I have to figure things out. The rougher it is sometimes, the more exciting it is. And, you know, Nepal and Kathmandu, where I ended up flying, I wouldn't say it's modern, but it's not Western easy or modern, right? So traffic everywhere. Motorcycles driving every which way, dust, smoke, loud noises, you know, crowded street vendors selling food on the street. I grew up in New York. This is not new to me. I mean, it's not as crazy as it is in Nepal, but okay, how bad could it be? Famous last words.
Sort of like an organized chaos, I always think of Asia. I mean, you know, whether it's Thailand or I imagine Nepal, you know, you've got that organized chaos where, you know, somehow nobody hits anybody.
Yeah.
and life goes on, but you just don't understand how that actually works.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So anyway, that's how I got to Kathmandu.
And I like that idea of like the self-guided discovery. You know, I think there's a lot of things that you just stumble on, you know, as you're just kind of walking through, you know, and finding the place and trying to take in the environment. There's a lot of kind of serendipity out there. You just like stumble on something. Oh, wow, what is this? You know, and you investigate, you see a shop, you see a group of people, you see something of interest and, you know, you're not with a group. So you can just kind of just take the time, investigate on your own and really discover something. I think that that is truly a part of travel that I definitely respect. Now, mind you, I also sometimes have those group-led tours with the flag, but I feel like both ways of doing things are valuable and a good way to kind of see the world.
And I want to point this out, though. We are speaking as three men where if I were a woman, I recognize that we are speaking from a position of privilege. Okay, so I want to acknowledge that. And I'm not saying there are not women who are very strong independent travelers. I am saying there is a different dynamic and it's not necessarily for everybody. And we may have a different lens of it as men. And for me, as a person of color, this is a podcast, so you can't see what I look like. I am an Asian male. So I kind of blended in Nepal. But anyway, just to say that there is a sense of, you know, I do have certain privilege that not everybody would otherwise feel comfortable with. And so the choices that people make, there's nothing wrong with that. And as I say to my clients, I have to meet you where you are and make sure that you are ultimately comfortable because you're the one taking the trip.
And I'll say as a father now that I've got a daughter and obviously a wife, I find that the individual tours can really be a game changer as well, where you've got the tour guide, potentially you've got a driver as well. I mean, yes, they cost a little bit more, but I think you get that personalized experience. You sometimes get the experience that you're not going to necessarily get in a larger tour, and you probably find things or are guided to things that you might not just find on your own. And so I think that can sometimes be a happy medium, but obviously, and I say this as sort of a program manager, like my day job, of you've got to balance that cost, the schedule or time, and the performance or the experience. And so it's always a consideration of the what we say that the iron triangle. But there's so many different ways to do it. What we like to say on the pod is you play your game. Everybody plays this game a little bit differently. And the way I do it is not necessarily right for you or Tom. And I think we have to acknowledge that, but I really appreciate you're highlighting the fact that we do have a little bit of a privilege in that we can walk into places that maybe others might feel a little bit more self-conscious, or in some cases, as much as we don't like to admit it, there are some places in the world that just aren't as safe. And while we might feel a little bit more confident doing that, a woman might not, and that's totally okay. It sucks to acknowledge that the world exists like that, but in some cases, it's just a fact. So let's sort of dive in here. You've gotten us to Nepal. I assume you're in Kathmandu?
That's correct. That's the only place I was in Nepal.
So did you have time before things started going off the rails to actually tour, to actually see the city, to get a feel for the country?
Absolutely. Well, a feel for Kathmandu, which is an urban environment, not for the country, because the country is not all urban. In fact, majority of the country is not all urban. I had 3 full days of normalcy in Kathmandu. As I said, the first two days and nights, I spent at the Hyatt Regency Kathmandu, which is very close to the airport, which is on the eastern side of the city. If you think of Kathmandu as concentric circles, in the very heart, not concentric circles, sorry, circles expanding outward, the very center of that circle is the historic part of the city, the old part of the city. As you move out from that center, as the radius expands, on the west side, you have what is unofficially called the Monkey Palace, Swayambhunath, because of all the monkeys that are there. And then on the eastern side, you have the largest stupa in Asia, Buddhanath. And so the Hyatt Regency Kathmandu was on the eastern side of the city. And that's where I stayed the first 2 nights because I arrived very late at night. It's only 2 miles from the hotel. And for Nepal, it's a luxury property. And indeed, it looked like Nepal, for those who are not familiar with the geography, is in the northeast part of India that is also on a border with China. So it's in the Himalayan mountain range. So if you know where India is, just go to the northeastern part of it. And before you hit that border with China, that's where Nepal is.
So a little funny story. I was trying to convince Tom that we should go there because number one, as you said, the Hyatts were cheap. And number two, there was a period of time where you could get like, I think, $1,800 round trips on Qatar Q Suites before the pandemic. And unfortunately, he didn't bite. So I've not made it.
We were this close.
So close. We were so close. But I have to ask, so you're in Kathmandu. Were you at all curious or tempted to take a flight to, I don't know where you fly into for Everest Base Camp, but I know that that's like one of those.
The most dangerous airports.
Yeah. But it's got to be an incredible experience, right?
So my girlfriend did do this. I think it's called Paro is the airport. I think that's the airport.
Is it the one for Bhutan or?
No, Paro is Bhutan. That's correct. I'm sorry. I'm forgetting the name of the most dangerous airport that you fly essentially to get to the start of a lot of the hikes. And there have to be special aircraft, and I think you have to have a special pilot certification, although I'm not really sure that that's actually adhered to. And supposedly, it is one of the most dangerous landings and takeoffs because of its position on some sort of cliff where one wrong move and you're off the mountainside.
Supposedly, there's only something like a dozen or two dozen pilots that are actually qualified to land there. And I think it's Lukla.
Lukla. That's it. Lukla. Yes, that's the one. But no, I did have curiosity. But given the time frame and given my objectives, I would have actually been curious just to say I did it because I like taking those flights. And just another brief aside, I know we're kind of getting off topic. You know, I've flown to the northernmost commercial airport in the world in Svalbard as part of the Arctic trip. And then the southernmost airport in the world in Ushuaia for the Antarctic trip. And so I'm very much a completionist. I like and doing things that are unique. It's like, well, if I do A, I have to do B. You know, and so going to Nepal is like, oh, really cool airport. Cool, in quotes, Lukla. But I couldn't make it work. And to be honest, it was not the driver of the trip. I did, in one of my 3 days that I had of normalcy in Kathmandu, was take a sightseeing flight to try and see the Himalayas, which I did see, and Everest, which I couldn't, because when I went, it was the tail end of monsoon season and there were too many clouds. But I still did get to see some of the Himalayas up close, which, again, is more than I would ever expect to do because I am certainly not hiking. I'm fit. I'm okay, but it's just not my jam.
No, and that's totally cool. So what kind of sightseeing aircraft was this? I assume like a Cessna or something a little smaller? Or?
No, it was a Q300, Q400, something like that. It was a propeller.
Oh, okay, so still a turboprop.
Yes, turboprop. That's correct. Yeah. Anyway, so I had 2 days, going back to the story, at the Hyatt Regency Kathmandu, which is on the eastern side of the city, did some exploration, you know, did my sightseeing flight, just walked around and just got my bearings. But I'll tell you, it was eerie. As I was walking around this hotel, which again is designed in a little bit of Indian style, if you kind of know it, it's kind of like a red brick, you know, intricate carvings, a lot of wood inside the hotel. Very beautiful, but very historic looking. It looked like a castle, but it was, you know, and it's probably just the New Yorker in me. As I walked in, I thought, man, even though there were guards stationed out front, it was kind of an open property. You know, it didn't feel guarded in any way. Not that I was worried about that at all when I first arrived, but I just took a look at the surroundings. I said, this is kind of an open space. It's kind of hard to defend, is what I'm looking at from that perspective. But 2 days of normalcy, had a wonderful stay at the Hyatt Regency Kathmandu. And then on day three, I transfer over to the west side of the city to Hyatt Centric Sewalti Mode Kathmandu.
And can we just put dates to this? Because given what we're going to get into in a moment, I feel like dates are actually really relevant.
Sure.
What day was it that you had actually moved to the Hyatt Centric?
I moved to the Hyatt Centric. Let's see. I believe Thursday was the 4th, 5th. I was at the Hyatt Regency 5th and 6th, Friday, Saturday, and then I moved to the Hyatt Centric on the western side of the city on Sunday the 7th. Check the dates, but basically it's starting on the Sunday.
So I'm looking at a timeline, and it looks like the 8th was a Wednesday, was day one of protests.
And actually, I was gonna ask, you know, before we start talking about things going off the rails, you know, for some of us that were, you know, somewhat familiar with the news, this might be a good time just for the listeners who did not catch all the stories for us to kind of talk about what actually precipitated here. Because, you know, I might need a refresher myself because I was aware of some stuff happening, but I'll be honest, I don't think I was following it as closely as may be necessary to understand some of what we're about to talk about.
And I actually wanted to sort of drive us a little bit of that way. I just got thrown off because I'm looking at this timeline. It sounds to me, based on what I'm looking at, and I'm not sure this is perfect. It's just a website. And, you know, if it's on the internet, it's obviously true. So it sounds like for September, the government ordered a ban on all social media apps that do not register in Nepal until the apps register themselves and follow the rules of the country. It sounds like you landed after the 4th of September?
Yes.
Were you aware this was all going on, or was this kind of a surprise for you as you were acclimating to Nepal?
The first 2-3 days, I had no idea that there had been any social media ban. I was on social media. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. So here is just to get the timeline straight. I landed in Nepal on Friday the 5th. And stayed at the Hyatt Regency. That's night number one. Saturday the 6th, I walked around by myself and on the eastern side of the city, stayed at the Hyatt Regency again for my second and final night at the Hyatt Regency Kathmandu. Sunday the 7th, I took my sightseeing flight. Because I'm Hyatt Globalist, I have a 4 p.m. late checkout, so didn't have to check out very early in the morning. Did my sightseeing flight. Then Sunday the 7th, I transfer from the northeastern side of the city at the Hyatt Regency to the southwestern side of the city at the Hyatt Centric Sewalti Mode Kathmandu. So my first night at the Hyatt Centric was Sunday the 7th. And again, no problems with social media. I had no idea. There was nothing that would cause any concern or nothing that was out of the ordinary. Life was normal. Now, here's another thing that I would say. Whenever I travel, I always register with the State Department STEP program, which is safe travel, or I'm not sure exactly what it is.
Smart Travel Enrollment Program.
Thank you. Yes, that sounds right. Even though I am a little bit wary of sharing my location with the government for a variety of reasons, not because of whomever might be in the White House, I just generally am very private with where I travel. I will share where I go on social media after I've been to a place, but not always while I'm right in the place. But I do register with a STEP program, and what this does is they alert you to any issues that you should be aware of as a U.S. citizen traveling in the country. And so I had registered with a STEP program before the trip. So everything is fine. I get no notifications. I landed on the 5th. I was okay on the 6th. 7th, I change hotels. No problem. Monday the 8th, I'm on the southeastern side of the city. I decide to visit that monkey temple, Swayambhunath. You know, I walk there. It was about 1.5 miles one way. You know, I had to walk up like 1,000 steps. I felt like I was making my own pilgrimage up the eastern steps to this stupa. Great view of the city. Everything is normal. Walked 1.5 miles back. Everything is hunky-dory. Great. Monday the 8th, I get an email from the STEP program saying, beware that there are protests in the southern part of the city near Parliament, and you might want to avoid the area. Okay, I wasn't anywhere near there. I was on the southwest part of the city. I wasn't getting involved in any protests, minding my own business. No problem whatsoever. Then, later on Monday, after everything is settled, I hear about that during the protests, then what they were protesting, let's get back to that. What they were protesting was not so much the social media ban. That was the catalyst, certainly, but really they were protesting government corruption. And there was a feeling, as I heard from local Nepalis, so it's a biased, what I heard was might be biased, but they felt that the social media ban was a way to prevent the communication and coordination of the youth, the Gen Z, they called it the Gen Z protests, from protesting against the government. And so Gen Z thought that the government instituting this ban was not for social and moral order, and because the social networks were not following the rules and laws that Nepal's government had set. They simply saw it as the young people, Gen Z thought, as retribution for fighting against corruption. In the protests that were taking place on that Monday, 19 students were killed. 19 people were killed, which set everything ablaze. Okay, so what turned out from was supposed to be peaceful protests into 19 people killed, all of a sudden, the anger is bubbling up and boiling. Similar things had happened in the region in the previous years. In Dhaka, Bangladesh, there was an uprising. In Sri Lanka, there was an uprising that was ultimately quelled, but the same dynamic was there. They felt there was government corruption. There was also this thing called hashtag Nepo Baby, nepotism, because they would see the children of the elected officials and the ministers and the Nepali government living these lush, lavish lives, traveling to international places. In the meantime, people in Nepal, the young people, couldn't get jobs. You know, they weren't earning enough money. So they were protesting that, they were protesting corruption, and then people were killed, which started the whole craziness on Tuesday the 9th. So I wake up on Tuesday the 9th. I have my water bottle in hand. I'm about to walk out of the hotel. Front desk says, whoa, Mr. Rubiano, where are you going? I don't know. I was going to walk to Durbar Square in the middle of town. No, you can't do that. And they said, I said, why? There is protests. It's supposedly going to get more violent. And I said, well, is it violent everywhere? You know, it's like, maybe I can go kind of go around. I mean, it's like, the city's kind of like a circle. They're protesting down here. I can go around. Like, no. There's going to be a curfew instituted. I was like, a curfew? What? Then I go back up to my hotel room. My hotel had 14 floors. I was on the top floor. Go up to the 14th floor. I said, well, I don't know. I guess I can't really go out today. I look out a big bay window at the end of the hallway, and I see black smoke erupting in the distance on a street. I said, oh man, there's a fire. Down the same street in almost like a straight line, more black smoke. Oh, that's odd. Down the same street, more black smoke. Four fires are blazing out. My first thought, man, this must be a gas explosion. I mean, the gas line must have popped and there's fires in four different places, but it's all along the same street. I said, oh, wow. Well, didn't put two and two together yet. I go to my room, has a big bay window. To my left, I see where the fires are that I spotted out of the hallway window. Looking straight ahead north, I see Swayambhunath, the monkey temple where I had walked. I look to my right, which is the heart of downtown, and I see even more black smoke. Turn on the news. Holy cow. Like, there are riots everywhere. Flames are bursting out all over the city. And now I realize, okay, this is something a little bit different. And it just got worse over the next several hours. I mean, huge balls of smoke everywhere. It turned out to be that one of the hotels, the Hilton, in the middle of the city that was owned by one of the ministers was set ablaze. And yeah, so that's when I realized we are in trouble here.
So walk us through what's going in your mind here. I mean, I've been in situations similar, not nearly as bad as what you've described, but do you go into the triage mode where you're starting to just sort of go through a checklist that you generally have in the back of your mind of if things are going pear-shaped, you just have to figure out transport, safety? Help us to understand sort of how you transitioned from this blissfully unaware, you know, with your water bottle to seeing effectively the city of Kathmandu on fire.
So let me say this. First of all, because of where we were in the southwest corner of the city, because it was still, other than the fires I could visibly see from the windows, things were not necessarily close to the hotel. And because the hotel staff at the Hyatt Centric, whom I have nothing but praise to give them for the professionalism, I mean, just wonderful staff who maintained order amidst the chaos, took care of us. They said everything was okay. We're in a safe part of the city. And I just sort of left it at that. Ignorance is bliss. And it really felt like it. I said, okay, I'm not going to get to see the city as I hope to see, but there's a protest. There's some serious stuff going on. I will stay put.
At least you're safe.
Safe at 14th floor. And, you know, we were under a general, the army, I don't know if they had imposed the general curfew at that point, but they said that they, at least on Tuesday the 9th, after things blew up, that, you know, there was going to be a general curfew in place. And I thought, okay, well, so far, everything in my mind is this is an unusual situation, but it's going to come under control. I'm safe in the hotel. Staff is saying we're safe. We seem like we're in a safe part of the city. Just going to roll with it. Let me tell you when the mindset changed. The mindset changed when I was in the downstairs. So they changed rules. If you've never been in a hotel, and I hope you never are, I hope you never will be. If you're ever in a place where you are sequestered and under lockdown, we got a note from the hotel saying that they told us to dim our lights in the room, to pull down the shades so that we wouldn't be targeted, and that they would not allow us to eat in common dining areas, that they would provide food in the restaurant buffet style. We'd take a plate and we'd take them up to our rooms and we'd eat in our rooms.
Did they share the logic there?
Yes, and it made sense. Basically, don't be on the first floor, you know, where the restaurant was, and try not to stand out. And you know, it's a tourist hotel, you know, congregating together. You don't know. Again, we didn't really know. A mob mentality takes on a life of its own. What started out as protests about corruption and nepotism and lack of job opportunities, lack of economic opportunity, blew up. And all of a sudden, you don't know which end is up and there are multiple fires going on. Better to be safe than sorry. So I understand the mentality of keep a low profile, right? Generally, a good idea, even if there were no riots going on. Keep a low profile. Try not to stick out when you're traveling. Blend in. Anyway, so the next day, this is Wednesday then. Tuesday was sort of a can't get out. Then Wednesday was the first day we're getting food in the buffet. I see kitchen staff like leaving the kitchen and going to the front of the hotel. That was a warning sign. That's a red flag. Like, you know, if everybody is bolting out of the restaurant, going to the front, a couple of us in there were getting food and the manager comes into us, it's okay. Everything is good. And I'm saying in my mind, if hotel staff is bolting out of the kitchen, I'd better get up back to my 14th floor room. That is the first time that I said, okay, the danger is getting close to home. And from the 14th floor, I get to my 14th floor room. I see a group congregating outside the hotel gates. Now, we had at the Hyatt Centric gates, unlike metal gates, not solid metal gates. You could still climb and use the gate steps as a ladder, but you know, metal gates that were closed, didn't go all the way up to the wall, so there was way to wait for it to be breached. Still better than the Hyatt Regency Kathmandu, which didn't have any real walls whatsoever, just a guard station. So I saw people congregating out of the front of the hotel, and a building across the street was set on fire. So now the danger is really getting close to home, right? It turned out to be a government building, you know, low-level government building across the street from the hotel, still on fire, still a group of people congregating outside of the hotel gates. That's when I started to shift my mindset of remain calm, but be prepared to evacuate. And it was, I can't say how, it's not like I went through, what does the State Department say? Let's Google, what should one do if caught in civil unrest? It became an automatic response. And I was telling somebody, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I'm originally from New York, New York City. I grew up here, you know, in the 70s and 80s, I took the subway when it was a little less safer, when the city was less safer in general than it is now. Now it's feels, and it is much safer than it was when I was growing up here. But you're always aware of your surroundings, and you always have an exit strategy. Never get backed into a corner.
So speaking of that, up until this point, you've talked about your top floor room as a safety benefit.
A sanctuary.
Yeah, a sanctuary. I'll be honest, my mind, I'm thinking, okay, that means that it's at least 14 stories worth of stairs if I've got to get down if the power goes out. That means it's going to take me a long time to evacuate if I actually have to evacuate. Maybe that's not a good idea in your situation based on the hordes at the gates. I'm thinking, is that a target? Is there some other aspect that is not necessarily good about being on the 14th floor? I'm not saying I want to be on the first floor, but that 14th floor to me seems almost like a liability more than, let's say, the fifth floor or the seventh floor. And maybe this is all arbitrary, but if you've got a city on fire, for lack of a better way of saying it, how long is the power going to hold out? We know that, you know, the different randomness, and maybe I'm out of practice on this with the emergency stairs, the regular stairs, sometimes they lock different floors. I'm running through in my head just all the risks of the 14th floor, let alone, you know, a lower floor and some of the other aspects. Is any of that running through your head? Or is this really the sanctuary in your mind because you've got the confidence in the hotel, the staff, maybe they've got the backup generator so you don't think the elevator is going to go out, et cetera?
Well, I felt safer on the 14th floor than I would be on a lower floor. I don't think they had rocket launchers, for example. I don't think anyone's going to throw a Molotov cocktail 14 floors up in the air. So from that perspective, I felt safe.
But fire goes up. I mean, that was just
fire
my mind.
Fire goes up. Yeah. No.
And the reason I'm thinking this is, I remember when I was doing research for my first trip into Thailand, and I probably haven't shared the story, and so I won't go into it. But at one point, the Red Shirts had effectively destroyed the lobby of the Renaissance over near the Erewhon Shrine and stuff. And so in my mind, I'm like, okay, if they can destroy the lobby, whatever fire or whatever they set, that's the ground floor. Everything goes up. But not to go tangent, I'm just want to get you know your mindset and that sort of thing.
No, I hear you. Yeah, that part, again, I was focusing on different emergencies. Okay, so the 14th floor was an asset because my window was going to be safe and da da da. I'll tell you the thing that did freak me out was, how would I know if the hotel was breached? The sensitivity meter started to go up. If I hear sounds outside my door, I am very quietly walking to the inside of my door, trying to look through the peephole, trying to evaluate friend or foe. Okay, so everything became much more acute, and every single noise had meaning. So it was a dual-edged sword. But now that I'm in sort of emergency mode, this is what I'm thinking. One is, where's the nearest exit? I had stairs right next to my room. Since I was I am a globalist, you know, they gave me a great room, had a big view, also happened to be near the stairs further away from the elevators. I thought that was a good thing because most people are not going to climb 14 stairs. I will go down. But again, the question of really what ran through my mind was, how would I know if the hotel was breached? I wouldn't. Then I start looking at, what are my belongings? I start thinking about, I travel very, very lightly. I have a carry-on only. One is my rollerboard. One is my computer bag. Oh, actually, in this case, it was a backpack that I had brought instead of my computer bag that served as my backpack, yeah, computer bag. In any case, I start thinking about, if I have to ditch, it's going to be the roller bag, right? I've got to carry the backpack. That means, and that it was three sets of things that I had to carry. One, what was going to be on my person? And I figured passport, spare battery for the phone, spare cable, anything other that was critical, which I can't think of now, but those things were like passport, cable, and battery were three things that I was going to carry, and my phone, of course. What's going to go in the backpack? This is where the calculus shifts, right? I pack very lightly, but even so, I had to think about, what am I going to put in the backpack in case I have to ditch the roller bag, roller board? And in that backpack, all of a sudden, I'm thinking about space and weight considerations. I'll tell you, one of the things that I was thinking of was, do I leave my electronic toothbrush, my Sonicare, and just use the manual toothbrush that the hotel gave me because it's lighter and smaller? But then I thought, what if I need to get into hand-to-hand combat? Things that I would not even think of. The Sonicare has a solid handle with a sharp tip. When the brush is not on it, I can use that as a shiv. I'm looking around my room. I see a coffee pot that is stainless steel with a handle. If the room is breached, that's something that could be used as a weapon. When I was going to bed that night, I said, what if the power goes out because of fire, because of electricity being cut off? I need to know where my stuff is so that I am able to navigate the room in a dark environment as if I were blind. I laid out my shoes, I opened them up, I had them unlaced, ready to step into. I had my backpack next to it. I had my passport battery cable on the bedside next to me. I debated, do I wear my clothes to bed? I said, okay, I'm going to just chill out just for a little bit, but I know where I'm going to put them. I had to make all those decisions, and that night was probably the most sleepless night that I've had in a long time, just thinking about all the things that could go wrong. What do I need to take in an emergency? What do I ditch? And when I went down to breakfast the next day at the hotel, I made sure to take my backpack because what happens if something happens and I can't get back up to the 14th floor? So that backpack went with me everywhere.
As you're saying this, the feelings that I had, the hair, you know, standing up on the back of my neck is coming back because I remember you sharing in a Facebook post, you know, a lot of these thoughts. And I was just thinking to myself, like, to be in that headspace, to be able to logically lay out all those different pieces and to not just give in to the fear or the hysteria, to be thinking to the level of, should I be sleeping with my shoes on? Should I be sleeping with my clothes on? where is this placement, that placement? Am I going to take a bottle of water from my room downstairs? Because in the event that I have to evacuate, I really want to have water, especially if they're throwing tear gas and all this other stuff out there. I mean, the level of in your head that you were able to share in a variety of Facebook posts, I felt like I was almost there with you. As I read it, it made me think of the No Way Out Owen Wilson, Pierce Brosnan movie, which I ended up watching after I got home because I was traveling as you were sharing this stuff. And I was just like, wow, just wow. I mean, to go through that, I've had some unique experiences. Thailand, coup d'etat, martial law. Yeah, that's nothing compared to this. And the way you just portrayed it was amazing. I think you, at one point, had talked about the airports were closed one night, but then the next night they were open, and you had this little wisp of hope of being able to get out.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through that? Can you tell us about that one?
So the first time I was really scared was when kitchen staff bolted from the restaurant. Second time was a lot of hope and heartbreak multiple times during the day. So general curfew is imposed. Airport is shut down. I am trying to rebook my cafe flight back to Hong Kong. They say I'm booked, but then the flight is delayed. It's delayed, you know, delayed 24 hours, then ultimately canceled. But then the next night, the airport is open for a brief window. And lo and behold, somehow, Cathay Pacific is actually sending an aircraft to Kathmandu. So it's not a false positive. I can track on FlightAware the aircraft flying from Hong Kong. It has departed. It's in the air. It's on the way to Kathmandu. I just need to figure out how to get to Kathmandu Airport. Kind of hard to do when there's no ground transportation that's being allowed still. Airport might be open, but there were still army checkpoints and some sort of curfew in the general city area. So I'm going down to the lobby of the hotel. I explain the situation to the front desk, and I've been getting resources and friends. I had a personal contact at the embassy, like thinking, is there a transport way that you can get me to the airport? Is there a way you can get me to the embassy? No, sorry, we can't do that yet, you know. Nepali army supposedly was escorting tourists safely, giving them safe passage, but they weren't doing it for individual travelers. They were doing it for groups of travelers. Think like tour buses that needed to be moved out en masse. Okay, that's not going to help me. The hotel had a car that was willing, the manager was willing to drive me himself. One small problem. Someone from the hotel had tried to take guests who were also trying to bug out and evacuate the day before when there was a brief window of time before the airport had been shut down. That car got stuck in the riots. The driver panicked, hit some people. The rioters pulled the driver from the hotel out of the car with the hotel guests and their stuff in the back, beat the driver, send him to the hospital, and set the car on fire. So the next night, there was no car for the hotel manager to take me to the airport, even though he was willing to do so. Great. So I just feel like I can't get a break here. You know, we have this opportunity. Cathay is sending the flight. It's supposed to take off at 2:15 in the morning on September 11. Mark that date down as a famous date. I just can't get to the airport. And the front desk is saying, I happened to run into some guests who had been staying at the Hyatt Centric, but for a variety of reasons, and I don't know how, I don't know why, they decided during the day to just make a change of hotels to the Sowalti, which is an Autograph Collection Marriott property, quote, just across the street. Remember that phrase, just across the street. So I randomly see these hotel guests. The only reason they were back at the Hyatt Centric after changing hotels was because they had left something in the room that they wanted to retrieve. And they overheard my plight and they said, well, our hotel has cars. The front desk at Hyatt Centric said, yes, the Sowalti has cars. They might be able to drive you, you know, or a taxi might be able to get there, etc. So I had to make a choice. I had to make a choice of stay in the safety of my hotel, 14th floor, even though there had been some questionable incidences about it being breached, possibly with rioters at the gate. They dispersed, thankfully. Or do I take my shot to get a ride to the airport at this other hotel because my flight is in? And if I don't get on this cafe flight, I have no idea when the next opportunity is for me to get out of Kathmandu. So streets are empty, and this is right across the street. I figure, how hard could it be? I cross the street all the time in New York. I jaywalk, you know, no problem. Take my roller bag, take my backpack, walking out. I don't see a hotel across the street. Oh, well, you guys got to walk down the street a little bit to the right. Like, okay. It's dark. It's quiet. This is a street that would be teeming with cars and people. It is silent. And there is nothing as freaky as being in a foreign country that has had general riots and is under general curfew to hear nothing but our footsteps and the rollerboard. Dragging my rollerboard, I say, okay, where's the hotel? We think it's this street. We got to take a left. And this is the kind of street, take a left, that you would never walk in New York in the middle of the night. It was dark. There was no clear line of sight. You couldn't see anything. I mean, this is a place where you were going to get jumped. All right, but safety in numbers. Yeah, there's three of us, two English blokes and me. We're walking down the street. No problem. Still no hotel at the end of this dark street. Then, oh yeah, we got to turn left. Okay, so I'm basically making a reverse C. If you think about my hotel, where it is, I went right, I went left, and now I'm going left again. It's a reverse shape C. On this last street, there's a little bit more light, thankfully, but all that meant was that the random wild dogs could see us and we could see them. They started approaching us, but there are three of us, right? They start walking around, doing their circling. No problem. Okay. Avoid the dogs, get to the hotel. Long story short, heart is broken twice. Find a car that is willing to take me. They can't get through the army checkpoint. They're stopped. They can't do it. Hotel has cars, but nobody from the hotel is willing to risk their car or their lives to drive me. So I am SOL. It's past midnight. I don't know what I'm going to, no way I'm going to make a 2:15 a.m. flight out of Kathmandu. And I don't have a room at the Sowalti. And besides, it's an autograph Marriott. I'm a Hyatt guy, right? I mean, I still got to get my free breakfast and all that.
Loyalty trumps everything.
So I was just like, look, am I going to stay at this autograph hotel or am I going to go back to the Hyatt? And they're like, well, it's not exactly just across the street, but it was close enough. So I take my roller bag, I take my backpack, I step out the safety of the hotel gates. Security guard says, you sure you want to do this? I was like, yeah, I can see my hotel. I just have to take a roundabout way to get there. Okay. Dogs are still on the street. Only one of them this time, though. It approaches me. No problem. One dog can deal with this. He was like the scout. Okay. He starts barking. Other dogs start coming down the street, surround me, right? I feel like I'm on a safari, like I'm fresh meat to these lions or these jackals, these hyenas. A couple start barking. And I said, you know what? I have gone through too much today and on this trip. I am not going to get taken out by wild dogs. I am going to keep rolling. If they want to come after me, bring it, because I have had it up to here. Thankfully, I just walked through the pack of dogs. They split. Okay, that item is down. Turn back down the dark street. Okay, that's, you know, I make through that street. Turn back to the other street where it's a little bit well lit. All right, I make through that street. Get back to the hotel. All right, back to the Hyatt, you know, made it. A little bit of heart pounding. Did it solo. Made it back. I said, what am I going to do here? I go back online. You know, I'm a big fan of booking direct. I not even use Amex Travel or Chase Travel, especially not Chase Travel. Amex Travel I have used in the past if it was a complicated itinerary because they're their own travel agency. You know, Expedia is terrible because they're an OTA, blah, blah, blah. So I said, what am I going to do? Cathay Pacific has gone. There's no other flight that they're operating in the next day or so. I don't want to wait 24 hours. I find a flight on Thai that is leaving at 1 p.m., so basically in about 12 hours, somehow, I just snag it. I try to book it on Thai directly. Thai's site is bonking out, right? It's just probably everyone's trying to buy this flight. So I said, okay, let me go to Amex Travel because they should be able to ticket directly. I go to Amex Travel, you know, pay cash for it, you know, fine, get out, bought the ticket. The next day in the morning, secured the flight. Next day, I slept maybe half an hour. I get report that the streets are going to open for about an hour. Airport has reopened. Anyway, make a long story short, hotel arranged transport, manager paid for it out of his own pocket, worked with somebody he trusted and knew before, not some rando, but a guy that he has driven for the hotel before, took me and another guest to the hotel, you know, and we went through a couple of army checkpoints. It was raining that day, so things were a little bit quieter. Riots had settled down by that point. Saw burned out buildings, burned out cars, destroyed parliament, just carnage, you know, everywhere, you know, and finally got to the hotel, and it was kind of like a scene like the cantina in Mos Eisley in Star Wars. Every nationality that could possibly be there with all their bags lined up in various lines trying to get to their airport desk just to get through your boarding pass and through security. It was a scrum, but never been so happy to see, to not have an elite line at an airport. I was never so happy as to be in an airport as I was then.
Wow. I'm just imagining almost refugees type feeling. Yeah. Like people just, you know, have whatever they could carry with them, just trying to get out.
Exactly. It was a great example of feeling like of what it would be like to be a refugee. Just had this dazed look on people's faces. Just kind of like, okay, you know, we just have to do a little bit more. We just have to get on the plane and it just has to go.
And you're literally working with these airline and airport employees who have obviously taken a great risk themselves just to get there, just to do their own jobs, to be able to get you out of that country.
Yeah.
That's a sobering feeling.
It is sobering. I mean, the hotel staff at the Hyatt Centric taking care of us when they had their own families and other worries to be concerned with, they were always making sure that we had food. They're still doing room service, limited room service, but still doing room service to make sure we had fresh towels. I was like, of all the things, you know, to be, it was just amazing all over. And the airport staff, they were just doing their jobs. They were hospitable. They were taking care of us. And yeah. So that's the story. I got out, made it to Bangkok, chilled out at the Hyatt Regency Bangkok Airport.
Let's just pause for a second.
Yeah.
You make it to 10,000 feet on that aircraft out at KTM. Walk us through that emotion.
Yeah. Are they clapping? You know, are people clapping?
No. No one was clapping. It was just, I breathed a sigh of relief when I saw that we were wheels up. It was more just, all right, the nightmare is over.
Did you look out as you were flying out?
I did. I took a video of, I was sitting on an aisle seat, but I stuck my phone in the direction of the window just to see us rotate and lift up. You know, I usually move all of my videos and photos off of my phone, but I do have some. You know, one is of the fires around the hotel that I could see from the hotel. One is of the carnage of burned out buildings and burned out cars. And one is of me standing in front of the Thai Airways plane because it's a air stairs. And then one video of when we take off. And then I get to Bangkok and it's just, you know, welcome, Mr. Rubiano.
And everything moves on. The world moves on, right? And everything's back to normal.
It was surreal. I was in Bangkok for one night. They had a wonderful, lovely, surprise and delight food spread for me in the room after I just gorged myself in the Regency Club Lounge. The next day I was in Hong Kong and I was standing at the peak, you know, on a beautiful day,
looking
at the harbor. And it was just very, very unreal. Surreal and unreal.
Incredible. I feel like these stories, I mean, are just so insightful for so many of us. I mean, everybody runs into a little pothole, but running into riots, city on fire, that's not common.
No.
I think it's, well, I would hope it's not common, right? But I think it's insightful for folks because when I've had situations, we had in 2015, I think the Thai military declared martial law and then coup d'etat. And when we were going to Thailand, my wife and I, I had backup plan after backup plan after backup plan, to the point where I was sort of like, okay, well, if things look really bad at Bangkok, where are the places? Are we going to go to, is it Rayong or Pattaya? Like, I want to be on the other side of Savanawapu Airport, because I think the traffic's going to be easier to get to the airport and ultimately out. Like, thinking about those things, I imagine that you're now probably going to be a little bit more conscious of what's going on in social media for a country that you're going to, if it's a new country to you, that sort of thing, or will you not? Does it change how you prepare for a trip?
That's a good question. And I don't know yet, because I haven't taken yet that next international trip. This was only about a month ago as we're recording this, so it's still fresh. I don't know. I would hope not. But I'm not sure yet, honestly. I don't know if it would just be muscle memory, things kicking in, like if it's an emergency, do this. But I don't know if I'd proactively change my behavior or be more worried ahead of time. But I'll tell you the next time I go to an international place.
The one thing that I'm hearing here, though, is from listening to your experience, I think people in kind of the miles and points community and you know, people who are familiar with kind of these situations, you know, we're pretty resilient. You made it out. You were able to book your own travel. You know, obviously, you had some harrowing things happen as you were trying to make your way out of the city into the airport. But you made it safely. You made it on the flight. You got back to normalcy, not without issue, but, you know, definitely safely. So I will say that the one thing that I think that people at Miles and Points, you know, just these, there's some just underlying skills that you have, you know, being able to track the flights, being able to look at alternative options, that makes us a little bit more resilient in these type of situations. And quite honestly, you know, those of our listeners who are listening to this, you know, this, it's good to hear these stories, because it makes you more aware of what can happen and what you should do. And it hopefully makes it so that you're not going to be as, you know, reactionary. You can kind of go back in their mind and think, okay, what did somebody else do? You know, these are, I think, good things to hear, just so that you feel prepared, you know, when the, you know, the unplanned happens, you know, you are better prepared. And I really thank you for your story, because it's just great to hear this tale, so that when something happens to me, hopefully it doesn't, but, you know, when it does, you have some experience of like, okay, how do you deal with some of it?
And if I could just build on that, and what I heard from you, Michael, is you went back to that first principle sort of approach. What do I need to survive? And then you just sort of blocked and tackled from there. You know, you got an impediment, and then you just figured out how you could either circumvent or surpass that impediment. And then you just moved on to the next thing. That's something that we learn, you know, in the Mile and Point community, right? You're looking for a flight. Okay, the nonstop on Swiss isn't available. Okay, but we know United's got one. And hey, we could even go out to Newark versus JFK. We got all these different options, and we don't let the optimal stop us from the good enough. We don't let something stop us from where we need to get to. We don't just say too hard and put our head under the pillow. And I think that your story is just such a great example of that.
Yep. Overcome adversity, you know, use all your resources. And yeah. Most of us, fortunately, you know, just through this hobby, we end up learning certain skills and having certain capabilities that come in pretty handy when the unplanned happens.
Yeah. Like, I mean, your Bangkok flight, right? You lost your Cathay. You're trying to get to Hong Kong. Okay. Logically, Bangkok's another good option, right? You're probably thinking Singapore might be another option. You're probably thinking, you know, maybe even Air India. Not that anybody wants to really dive into that. But I mean, you're probably thinking of what other airlines are flying into Kathmandu, you know, normally. And then you start looking at who's actually, at, you know, flying. So you probably had, I would imagine, 5 different options as you're trying to figure out how you were going to get out of Dodge.
Well, I would say I didn't exactly have 5 different options because of the limited flights that were available, but the mindset and the process of thinking about it certainly was very applicable. You know, finding options. It's not going to be the nonstop. It's not going to be at the time I want. I don't care about that. I just need to figure out. It's like that scene from The Martian at the end where Matt Damon's character is addressing the class. It's like, you solve one problem, you solve another, then you solve another. You solve enough problems and you get to go home. And that's exactly what it was. Just solve one problem at a time. Worry about what's right in front of you. And this is where you go from the strategic thinking, where in the miles and points community analogy, strategic thinking, well, I could play this out. I could use these miles instead of these miles. I could transfer from here. I get to stop in this. That's strategy. The tactic is, let us execute on what is available and let's take it before we lose the option altogether. And then figure out your next step once you make it through that step.
Yep. So well said.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So I think we should probably close it out here. This has been incredible. Just your experience, the just raw emotion, really incredible. But I don't want to leave it on that note. I'd like to sort of pivot, if we could, and just give you a chance to share how our listeners can find you. I know that you had mentioned that you're a luxury travel advisor. What sort of thing do you do as a luxury travel advisor? How can they find you, whether it's on social media or otherwise? Just want to give you an opportunity to share that with us.
Well, thanks so much. So what I do as a luxury it's a travel advisor. I do focus on the luxury segment, but I have several clients who are also not luxury. That could be simply finding hotels in various places and hopefully getting you some extra perks if I can with my affiliations. It might be adventure travel, be it scuba diving, maybe going to Antarctica or the Arctic, both of which I've been to and I have great stories to tell another time on a podcast if you invite me back. You know, flight assistance. Anyway, the way that you can find me is with Michael, first name, MICHAEL.Rubiano, R-U-B as in boy, I-A, N as in Nancy O, sorry for the phonetic misspellings there, at Fora, Foxtrot Oscar Romeo Alpha dot travel. T-R-A-V-E-L, michael.rubiano at fora.travel. You can reach me there if you need any assistance. And I am on Instagram, theoretically, at jetsetter, J-E-T-S, as in Sierra, E-T-R, J-E-T-S-E-T-R on Instagram. But don't expect me to be very active there. Reach me via email. And if you're a good friend of the podcast, you might get my phone number from Trevor or TK.
And I will say, you helped us. We haven't talked about it on the pod yet. We still have to record, but you helped my family and I have an amazing charter of a beautiful boat in La Spezia, Italy. And I truly appreciate that. You cut through the noise. You made it nice and easy. And I think that's what makes working with someone like yourself so easy. Because I know I wasn't responding as quickly as as I should have.
No, it's my pleasure. You know, I actually, you know, yes, I can do the flights, I can do the hotels, I can do the adventure travel, but helping find people what they want to do, if that's a tour, if that's a boat, if that's, you know, finding personalized guides or drivers that you need in working on those types of problems, I love solving the problems. It just happens to be with a travel focus. So if you're curious, if you have questions about travel, if you have questions about, I'm curious about this part of the world. Like I said, I've flown about 2.1, 2.2 million miles, button seat miles, been to all seven continents. There's a good likelihood I've been someplace. If you have a question about it, shoot me an email. Happy to help.
Awesome. And we do really hope to have you back on to hear about your Antarctic cruise. I know that that's an aspirational thing that my family has. I definitely have it. And we'll just say the whole family does. I'll negotiate that one later.
You know how to reach me, and I'll happy to talk about it whenever you next have me on.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Michael. Really appreciate it. This is definitely a story I think a lot of people will find insightful. Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.